Hello and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Lori Wagner, a member of the club's LGBT forum and your chair for today. We also welcome our listening audience and we invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speakers. Stuart Gaffney and his husband, John Lewis, have been prominent voices speaking out for marriage equality in the local, national, and international media since 2004. They were plaintiffs in the landmark California marriage cases, 2008. At their national organization, Marriage Equality USA, Stuart serves as a media director and John an attorney as legal director. They've been profiled in Time, Newsweek, The Catholic Register, Asian Week, and appeared on NPR Morning Edition, as well as John's recent appearance on MSNBC's The Ed Show with Cyndi Lauper. Through the ups and downs of the movement, Stuart and John have been stalwart keepers of the flame, showing up at every marriage equality event, posting every bit of news, with John dissecting the legal briefings in ways non-lawyers can understand. Among their many achievements, their 25th anniversary is this year, and a personal success that we all admire. Robin McGeehee is a Southern transplant who lives in Fresno and teaches at the College of the Sequoias while raising her two children. The recipient of a 2001 Martin Luther King Jr. Award for her work on youth empowerment, she responded to the Prop 8 loss in 2008 and the frustration that the LGBT political strategist had completely overlooked Fresno by organizing a march called Meet in the Middle in Fresno. This march drew attendance from the entire state. She was then recruited to co-direct a national march on Washington in 2009 and in 2010 formed Get Equal with Kip Williams. Her journey post-Prop 8 led to pictures of her being arrested with Dan Choi at the White House fence, a picture of her with a megaphone in her hand on a boat off the coast of Florida, where Obama was attending a fundraiser, effectively reminding him of our existence, and a picture ultimately as an invited guest at a White House reception. A visionary leader, she's now striving with dreamer activist Felipe Matos, Get Equal's new field director, and others working in the intersections of social justice to ensure that our gains are consolidated and nothing short of full equality is achieved. And now to begin the program, I'd like to welcome John and Stuart to start.
Thank you so much, Laurie. It's really a pleasure to be here, and it's great to see wonderful familiar faces and new faces. And so what we thought we would do together, see how those 25 years together are still working out as a couple, we will speak together, just tell a little bit about our personal story, and with that, integrate some of the developments that have occurred through the years and the current legal developments on marriage equality. So integrate the two together. Just to begin, for us, it really began with this tax form, the old 1040 that you probably recognize. It was April 14th, about 7:30 or so in the evening. We had that was early for us. We had all the forms, you know, spread across the kitchen table, and we came to this place where it says filing status, and we had been together for 16 years at that point. And you just look at the filing status, and it says single or married. And I don't know, it just hit us that year. You know, our federal government is forcing us with our own hand, under penalty of perjury on the other side of the form, to lie about the nature of our family, our relationship, and to deny our human dignity and declare ourselves single. And then fill out all the numbers and write a check to the same government that won't give us basic equality and dignity for a substantially larger amount of money. And we have come to learn that that fact about unequal treatment and taxation, money that, you know, we could use for savings for retirement, just like anybody else could, that's just one of over 1,000 rights under federal law that come with marriage and marriage alone under American law. And those rights are very, very important, spanning all sorts of aspects of our lives. And we're going to talk about those just in a little bit. But we decided we need to get active in the marriage equality movement. So what we did was we were following the news and the papers. This was back in 2003, 2004, and we learned that there was going to be a rally on the steps of San Francisco City Hall about 11 o'clock or noon. And I would go to the rally, report back to Stuart that night, who was going to be at his office downtown, and we would start supporting the cause and see what happened. You know, we're rally-type people. Go to the rally. Show up. So I got to the rally February 12th. 2004, for anybody who remembers and was living here, it was the very first hour that Gavin Newsom and the city and county of San Francisco had opened the door to lesbian, gay couples and any loving couple to walk right into City Hall and get married. So I asked Molly what was the plan for the wedding, the rally, and she said, "You can go right in and get married." I didn't own a cell phone. I didn't know how they worked. She said, "Here's one." I feverishly, like, I got to get Stuart. He's going to be at lunch. We're going to miss our chance. And so I called him.
And I was at my desk just a few blocks from here, actually, and the phone rang. And it was the most urgent wedding proposal you've ever heard. And it went something like, "Get to City Hall right now." But it was very romantic because we knew that this was historic. It was also fragile because we were worried that a court might put a stop to the weddings at any moment. So it was critical that I get to City Hall right now. So I made what could have been a fatal mistake. I went underground and got on Muni, although today maybe it would have been BART. But luckily it got me to City Hall on time, and I rushed to that beautiful building, and there was my groom-to-be pacing on the steps.
And we dashed right through City Hall, through the metal detectors as quick as possible, and then we just stopped. We sort of giggled for a moment, and then we said, like, how do you get married? Like, what do you do? And
it's a funny moment because marriage is such a central dream in our culture, whether or not you want to get married. We've been to so many other people's weddings, but because it seemed like it was always a dream for someone else and not for us, we didn't know how.
And we figured it out, got to the clerk's office, paid our fee, and then in the most deadpan voice, we're handed this.
Our family planning and pregnancy information. And at first, it reacted just like you did. But upon reflection, actually, this is one of our favorite wedding gifts, because what we realized as we were handed this form is any two people who walked through the doors of City Hall that day were treated exactly the same. You paid the same fee, you filled out the same application, you received the same pregnancy and family planning information, and you received a marriage license. And it was just by virtue of your humanity, because you were two people who wanted to get married.
And then, of course, there's something very special about it because it was just the two of us. But then on the deeper, more profound sense, you know, we got up that morning. I was going to a rally. I tell everybody whenever we speak, go to the rally. Show up. You never know what's going to happen.
It could be your wedding day.
And because we showed up, literally, we showed up to try to get involved, we got to be one of the first 10 couples in the entire United States who are lesbian and gay who got married because we showed up, just simply showing up as ordinary folks. And we heard those words, by virtue of the authority vested in me by the state of California, I pronounce you spouses for life. And whoa, I did not see it coming. I did not see it coming. It just hit me, and I feel these shivers that went up and down my body because I realized I never thought I was going to hear those words. I always thought, as a gay person, I was going to be somehow just a little bit second best. A domestic partnership, a civil union, but never full equality. And I realized this is the first time in my life that I feel that my government, our laws, are treating me as an equal human being, as a gay person. Wow. This is what it actually feels like. It feels like, not reading about it, thinking about it, what it feels like to be equal. And that changed everything for us. We said, we have just got to do everything we can to make this reality a lasting reality for ourselves. We knew that these marriages were on somewhat unstable legal ground. But to make it a lasting reality for ourselves and for anybody else who wanted that. And also that we saw that getting married and having marriage equality was not just about our relationship, not just about ourselves, but our basic dignity as lesbian and gay people, lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender community. And the movement was really about full equality on every single aspect of our lives. So a truly profound moment.
And we know now that those marriages actually went on for 30 days, and thousands of happy couples got married. We actually had plans to go out of town that weekend already. It was a holiday weekend. We canceled those plans so that we could spend our honeymoon in, literally, the offices of the ACLU, filing our first declaration in support of the legal action to support marriage equality in California and across the country. We really felt that that was the best honeymoon, though, because it was the best way to honor our wedding vows, to stand up for our marriage.
And so you might know, 6 months later, there are over 4,000 couples who got married in San Francisco City Hall from all over the world. But 6 months later, the California Supreme Court said that the city and county of San Francisco couldn't do this on its own. It had to ask the California Supreme Court first. And they declared all those marriages, including ours, null and void. At that point, when our marriage was declared null and void, Stuart and I then joined exactly what the court had asked to happen, the ongoing lawsuit to actually have California's state statutory ban on same-sex couples getting married declared unconstitutional under the state lawsuit, under the state constitution.
And lawsuits take time. I think we all know this, as we are currently waiting for many courts in many different jurisdictions to weigh in on our rights. As we waited for almost 4 years for the marriage case to go through every level of the California court system, we took a lot of encouragement from another couple that we knew pretty well. My mom and dad, an interracial couple, who were only able to marry because the California Supreme Court did the right thing in 1948 and overturned the state's ban on interracial couples being able to marry. So here they are getting married at UC Berkeley, actually at the International House where they met. But my mom before that was a student at Cal when it would have been illegal for her to marry my dad. She was a member of the Chinese Students Club and remembers when a classmate of hers had to leave the state in order to get married because she'd fallen in love with someone of a different race. Much the way a same-sex couple in California would leave the state today if they wanted to get legally married and go to one of the other states that does have marriage equality.
So, as Stuart said, lawsuits take time, and it took 4 years. But on May 15th, 2008, about 10 in the morning, the California Supreme Court declared that the state's ban on lesbian and gay people getting married did violate the state constitution and that all loving committed couples should be able to marry in California.
So that was at 10 a.m. when the court releases its decision, both online and printed copies, and Kate Kendall with NCLR burst through the doors of the California Supreme Court waving the decision. Everybody knew it was good news. A cheer went up from the legal team, the plaintiffs, the community. We knew that justice had been done. So that was at 10 a.m. And then at 10:01 a.m., my cell phone rang. It was my mom. And she said, "When's the wedding?" And I said, "Mom, you know, you must have heard the good news, and we're celebrating on the courthouse steps with the community and the plaintiffs and the legal team." And she said, "That's nice. When's the wedding?" And I said, Mom, the ink is barely dry in the decision. We don't actually know when it's going to be final. And she said, when's the wedding? And that was when I realized.
That's your mom.
I sense my mother at work. That's when I knew that my mom actually had been waiting. At that point, we've been together over 20 years to plan a wedding with us. And up until that moment, it hadn't been possible. And here we are, actually, as you know, we got married very spontaneously in 2004. There wasn't time to invite any guests. There wasn't time to tell anyone beforehand. John barely got me to the wedding. We're better dressed today than we were on that wedding day. But in 2008, we had the time to do it right, both in the sense that we got dressed up appropriately, and also that we could invite our friends and family, and our beloved community was there too. And actually, I'm just going to ask for a show of hands for our family members who are here today. We have amazing love and support here. David, you too. was a beautiful moment, not just to be surrounded by family and friends, what so many people expect on their wedding day, but also having all of our living parents there, having my mom and dad witness the next generation in our family achieving marriage equality and being able to legally marry in California just as they had.
And so, getting into a little bit of the legal aspect of it, California Supreme Court decision was really profound, it's really, I believe, what our community and what equality-minded people believe should be the standard nationally. And there are two things that were truly profound about the California Supreme Court decision, and one was. It was really the first time that any state in our nation had said, by ending the barrier for lesbian and gay people to get married, it ended up for the first time in our nation that any human being could marry the human being that they chose to marry, regardless of any external factor. It didn't matter your race, your national origin, your religion, if you're disabled, if you're your sexual orientation, your gender identity, it didn't matter. The fact that you were a human being willing to commit to another human being gave you the fundamental constitutional right under a state constitution to have the state recognize your relationship and give you the rights and responsibilities of the highest degree. And that was the first time that it ever happened. And something that I think is really beautiful about the way California actually has uniquely articulated this standard. Back in 1948, in the Perez decision, which was the decision that ultimately allowed Stewart's mom and dad to be able to get married here, they said, every person has a fundamental right to marry. And the essence of that right is that you get to choose who you want to marry. How can it be otherwise? And how can the state, there they're talking about race, how can the state say you can marry these people but not those people? The essence is that it's your choice because it's your family, it's your life. And then 50 years later, the California Supreme Court, in essence, said the same thing. How can it be if you tell a gay or lesbian person you can marry a straight, you know, it made no sense. It has to be the person that you choose. And then the other thing that the California Supreme Court said was that just like classifications in the law based on race and national origin and gender, we are finding that when a law treats a lesbian or gay person differently from everybody else, just like a law that treated somebody of a racial group differently from everybody else, that law is presumptively unconstitutional and will only be upheld in the very narrowest of circumstances, essentially never. This had never been held before by a state Supreme Court, and it was a true breakthrough. And it was truly important because the California Supreme Court got it. They understood, in essence, that the marriage equality movement wasn't just about the right to marry. It was about the dignity of lesbian and gay people and protections for their dignity and their lives in all aspects of their lives. So that decision was about marriage as the example, but it protects a lesbian or gay person to this day, whether you be in a school and they try to treat you differently, if you're in jail, if you're at a job, if you name it, it protects you in all aspects of your lives. So two profound things, and that is really what we want to achieve on the national level, which we don't have yet, unfortunately. But as we move now to a brief discussion of where we're at with some of these federal lawsuits that are so much in the news right now, that is what our ultimate goal is to achieve the full fundamental right to marry for every person in this country, wherever you live, and to achieve that highest protection under the law in our Constitution in every aspect of your life as a gay person. So, as you all know, unfortunately, after there were about, well, from June to November, there were, this is fortunate, 18,000 couples were able to marry in California who are lesbian and gay. But in November, Proposition 8 passed by a narrow margin, which took away the right to marry in California. So, in response to the horror of Prop 8, we could talk all night about the horror of that, a lawsuit was filed in federal court, and it was a lawsuit directly challenging Prop 8 and saying that, yes, just as I articulated before, there is a fundamental right to marry that lesbian and gay people have too. And a law that discriminates against us should be treated with that same intensified scrutiny that laws that discriminate on race do too. So as in everything in the courts, it takes a long time. It takes a long time. But as you probably are aware on the news, earlier this year in February, the Ninth Circuit Federal Court of Appeals ruled in our favor. What's particularly significant about the decision is that they issued the decision on a narrow grounds. And they decided not to issue the big landmark decision about these issues of your fundamental right and strict scrutiny, as it's called in the law, about classifications and race and gender and this sort of thing. But what they said, we're going to look at this law closely, and we're going to see that the Prop 8 does something that has never been done before, something that is unique. And that was, it targeted lesbian and gay people who had the full constitutional right to marry under their state constitution, and it took away that right for no other reason than to make them unequal to everybody else. Because it left intact our state domestic partnership law, which provides every other substantive right and responsibility. So California was this very clear case where there was no other possible reason, there was no policy, there was nothing else stated except to stamp a lesbian and gay person as inferior to everybody else just because they're gay. And what the court said was, you know, putting aside whether or not there is a fundamental right to marry, laws should be under very intensified scrutiny if you're lesbian or gay, putting that all aside, this law in and of itself is unconstitutional because it so targets lesbian and gay people. So it's the next question was whether the Ninth Circuit would rehear the case before a larger panel. And just last week, as you probably know, the Ninth Circuit decided not to rehear the case, and now the case is teed up. The opponents of equality, those who supported Prop 8, have 90 days from last week or early September to ask the United States Supreme Court to hear the case. And, of course, everybody's waiting and watching and wanting to know what will happen. Because the case is on narrow grounds, it is possible that they will decide not to hear the case. It's a real possibility. We just don't know. It's a possible they'll take the case and they'll affirm it on narrow grounds, or they will issue a broader decision, or they could reverse it too. So that's one case that's going on. And I have to say, for a moment, just as a quick aside, it was truly a gay marriage decision, because I don't know who actually read the thing, but the judge in writing it actually cited Marilyn Monroe. And he said, you know, Marilyn Monroe's movie, How to Marry a Millionaire, just wouldn't be the same if it was How to Register a California Domestic Partnership with a Millionaire. So keeping on those themes, we have had so many successes on cases now challenging the federal so-called Defense of Marriage Act that I like to say it's not raining men, it's raining DOMA cases. It's raining victories in Defense of Marriage Act cases. So in short, because I want to keep to our time here, the Defense of Marriage Act, so-called, was this federal law passed in 1996 as part of the presidential political campaign. It was passed in September and signed into law by President Clinton.
A Democrat.
It was attempting to create a wedge issue, which he gave into and signed it into law anyway. So it deprives lesbian and gay couples of all the 1,138 rights under federal law. So there are lawsuits. There's 17 lawsuits at last count all across the country now challenging this on many, many different grounds based on all the different ways from Social Security to tax to immigration to military benefits to all sorts of ways that federal laws touch our lives. And the good news is that we have gotten positive decisions in all of the cases with decisions. And now we have 8 judges appointed by both Republican and Democratic presidents that have all ruled in our favor that the Defense of Marriage Act is unconstitutional. And I just wanted to highlight a couple. It's tremendous. Just sort of on the timeline of things, version of it, the case that's farthest along is a case called Gill out of Massachusetts, decided in the First Circuit Court of Appeal. And that decision was issued on May 31st. And they have a choice to ask the en banc or full First Circuit to rehear the case. They have 45 days to do so, or in middle of July. It's quite possible they will not do that, the losing side, and that they will just ask the United States Supreme Court to hear the case directly. If so, they're going to be asking the court just about the same time that the Prop 8 case would get to the U.S. Supreme Court. The court doesn't have to take either of the cases. It's in their discretion. A couple reasons why the Defense of Marriage Act case is, if you will, an easier case on our side, because it's not raising the question directly about whether any state has to marry a lesbian or gay couple or not. It's just saying if you are a lesbian and gay couple who is legally married in your home state, one of the 6 home states plus California, then you should have federal rights. And the courts have found this argument very persuasive because they've looked at not only the way that this act was passed with overwhelming speed for such an important federal act. There was one day of hearings about it. There was no testimony about the effect it had on lesbian and gay people. It is really unprecedented in American law for the federal government to target a group of people and define marriage. The federal government, for all other purposes, essentially defers to what the states say a legally married couple is under their state laws. They defer. But for the first time, and once again getting this idea, they targeted lesbian and gay people. So the courts are not, so far, buying the sorts of policy rationales that are being offered for the law. And we're very hopeful that the Supreme Court will do the same. We just have a couple minutes left for what we're saying here. I just want to say one thing really quickly about what I think what is really important trying to understand a little bit substantively about where these cases might be decided. And that is, I think it's really important. And what the Supreme Court has said is, in essence, that, you know, we have all sorts of views, personal views. And this is in Supreme Court precedent. We have all sorts of ideas about what is morality. People have various views on homosexuality about morality. But in a landmark case called Lawrence versus Texas, they said a very key thing. And they said, you know, the issue of what you think of these various moral views is not really before us. But the issue is whether the majority in our society may use the power of the state to enforce its views on the whole society through the operation of law. And they said, our obligation as the United States Supreme Court in interpreting the Constitution is to define the liberty for all people, not to mandate a moral code. And I think it's a really profound statement. I think it's a beautiful articulation. I think where the real grit will come at the United States Supreme Court will be whether an idea that people can try to define marriage as just between a man and a woman is such a moral code. Justice O'Connor, in her concurrence in this opinion, said that she didn't think it was a matter of morality. And Justice Scalia fires back in the dissent saying that you want to preserve the tradition of marriage, it's just a kinder way of making a moral judgment about same-sex couples. He's against us, we presume, and he was dissenting in the case. But he really cut through it. And he cut through the fact that to define it in such a way really works in exclusion. And it says that lesbian and gay people not only are being cut out of the fabric of American life, but out of very important legal rights and responsibilities. And I want to read one other quote from this Lawrence versus Texas decision, because it's the last word we've had so far. Is 9 years ago in a landmark case about lesbian and gay rights. It was about the right not to be put in jail for having intimate sexual relationships with somebody of the same gender. And this is the way they conclude the opinion. And this is this language, though, is applying particularly to that issue. I think it really does set the tone for why I'm very hopeful that ultimately there should be 5 votes on this court, because what I'm about to read you is the law of this nation. And that's as follows. Had those who drew and ratified the due process clauses of the 5th and 14th Amendments, had they known the components of liberty in their manifold possibilities, they might have been more specific. They did not presume to have this insight. They knew that times can blind us to certain truths, and later generations can see that laws that once were thought necessary and proper, in fact, only served to oppress. As the Constitution endures, persons in every generation can invoke its principles in their own search for greater freedom. That's a constitution I can sign on to. And that is the law of this land. That is the majority opinion of the United States Supreme Court. And, of course, we're very hopeful that whenever this issue gets to the court, that they will be relying on that basic principle of our common humanity and our common sense of justice this country is founded upon.
I'd like to thank John and Stuart for their comments here today. We'd like to remind our listening audience that this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California, and you are listening to Getting Equal in Marriage Equality Movement with Stuart Gaffney, John Lewis, and Robin McGeehee. And now I'd like to welcome Robin.
Thank you. I want to thank John and Stuart. I've seen them at many rallies, so they spoke about the rallies and the protests that we have seen numerous events over the course of the fight for getting equal. But I've never had the luxury of sitting and listening, and that was beautiful. So thank you very much. And even the PowerPoint presentation in its true form was amazing. So thank you. And while I was sitting here, I got the luxury of seeing some of the things that they didn't present. And one of the things that stood out to me was the Prop 8 mailer that came from the anti-equality movement, using the words of now President, then President-elect, Barack Obama. And I'll never forget going to some of those rallies at the time in Fresno, California, you know, in an area that I see as behind enemy lines. You know, growing up in the Central Valley or raising children in the Central Valley, you're reminded so much that it's nowhere near the metropolitan areas of California that you dreamed, you know, it being. And for me, growing up in Mississippi, I ran as fast as I could from Mississippi, and I realized that I planted my feet in the very soul that I tried to run away from. And in this particular situation, I feel like while I was going door-to-door giving out signs that said, "Elect Barack Obama," in a very red area of the state, I was also going door-to-door trying to get people to understand that we were fighting for our dignity. And to come home and find a mailer like this, using the words of then-President-elect Barack Obama speaking against our families, and not feeling like at the time he did enough to stand up for us, we have come a long way if you think about his recent evolution. And I just want to briefly talk about kind of what led to my moment of even sitting here. I feel humbled to be with John and Stuart today because they were at the forefront of what is now, you know, the landmark Prop 8 case. But the landmark Prop 8 case doesn't happen without the 10 individuals standing there at City Hall saying we're going to, you know, get married today. And then I'd like to just briefly talk about where we're going in reference to Get Equal's agenda, because for me it's so much more than just fighting for marriage equality, which I know that's exactly how John and Stuart feel as well. And for my own personal journey, it was just being a lesbian mom living in the Central Valley, dealing with the situation of being behind enemy lines and not feeling like the statewide organizations had done enough to fight for us and with us in the Central Valley, and it was, you know, homegrown activists who were kind of taking the fight into their own hands. And because I spoke out, I was the president of my son's parent-teacher organization, the PTA. And after we lost on a Tuesday, that Friday, I was asked to resign from the PTA because my son was at a Catholic elementary school. And they completely knew everything about our family. We were very active to gay male fathers, to lesbian moms. They even pursued us to be, you know, heavily involved with the PTA because they saw us as good, you know, event planners and fundraisers. You know, leave it to the queers. And, you know, ironically, after we lost is when they made that decision, or when the priest made the decision that they won and they were going to silence me. And at that moment, I thought, well, they're not going to stop until they get a nice little fence in the foothills that they can all put us behind, and, you know, put us behind a fence. And, you know, even as the North Carolina pastor said so eloquently and just put it right out there after they lost in North Carolina, electrocute us one by one. And I said, instead of him saying it in, you know, real world terms, he's saying it in first silencing and the burning of the books in my, you know, metaphor. So my only choice was to do exactly what Stuart and John talked about, was we need to fight back. And that led to organizing with lots of people in the Central Valley, a statewide reaction, which was Meet in the Middle, and then marching on Washington. And what I learned in all of that was, okay, we've brought, you know, 5,000 to 6,000 people to Fresno, California, in the reddest area of the state. We took 250,000 people to Washington, D.C., demanding full equality. And President Obama goes to the HRC dinner the night before, and I still don't feel like we really have any progress. And at that moment, I said, I'm tired of being the let's change hearts and minds nice gay. I'm ready to, you know, go on the shoulders and the imagery of the civil rights movements that we've seen before us and actually pursue this the way we watched ACT UP pursue the rights and the protections for the AIDS movement. And let's really start putting our lives on the line in reference to protests that are not nice. Arrest and, you know, blocking intersections and, you know, disrupting public speeches, et cetera. And luckily, you know, we had the luxury of meeting people that also were in that frame of mind and that thinking. And sadly, I never wanted to look at President Obama, a person that I did really work to get into office, as the opposition. But I truly believe that we were sitting at a moment that was a political window that was closing, and that we had the luxury at that time of the House and the Senate and a Democratic president, and everything that we were hearing in reference to Don't Ask, Don't Tell was they want to do it, but they're probably not going to be able to do it. And, you know, with a president such as former President Bill Clinton giving us DOMA and giving us DADT, Don't Ask, Don't Tell, in my opinion, we have to pressure our friends as much as we have to pressure our enemies. And we have to pressure our friends sometimes even more adamantly and urgently because they have the social obligation to do something about it, where our enemies are just clearly against us to begin with. So that led to many moments of, you know, being chained to the White House fence, shutting down traffic on Las Vegas Boulevard to try to get Senator Harry Reid's attention, and numerous media narratives where Nancy Pelosi was pointing at Harry Reid was pointing at Nancy Pelosi, and then both of them were pointing at Barack Obama, all blaming each other. And a lot of times, you know, the sad reality, being the person who wants everybody to get along, it was not fun being looked at as the anti-Democrat or the rabble-rouser. Because I wanted our national organization, specifically the Human Rights Campaign and the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force, to stand up to the Democrats that we had put into office. And ironically, the middle part of that story is one of the things I learned in November of 2010, right before we got the vote that repealed Don't Ask, Don't Tell. We got a phone call from Nathaniel Frank, who had worked with lots of different organizations, but specifically the Palm Center in Southern California. And he's calling me on my cell phone, and I knew of him just because I, you know, was a studier of blogs and, you know, reading LGBT media before I'd really got involved in the LGBT fight. And he said, "Hi, Robin, this is Nathaniel Frank," and this is the very beginning of November. And he said, "I don't mean to bother you." And I was like, oh, my God, if Nathaniel Frank is calling me, just this nobody mom from Fresno, California, then we are in trouble in reference to the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And his comment was, does Get Equal have anything planned? And this was, you know, like I said, November 1st or 2nd. And I said, well, we don't have anything planned because we're just trying to survive. And our fight is not really military service. It's not marriage equality. It's a full equality agenda. And I said, we really are looking to sustain because we want to survive to be able to fight going into the next year. And we feel like we've kind of done everything that we can do. And he said, well, all I can say is if there is not a high-profile action, I don't believe that this is going to happen. And what I knew from that is if we had – November was here, so we knew we had lost the House – and I said, well, if this doesn't happen by the end of November, then we know that we're going to lose the lame duck session and we're going to go into 2011. And that means Don't Ask, Don't Tell doesn't have a chance in hell. Excuse me for the radio. Doesn't have a chance in the new session. You know, there's not, you know, any way that this House would have passed the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. So in 2 weeks, we organized 13 people to take the fence. And the point of what I learned in that moment was, 2 days later, we were invited to come and speak with the White House just in a, you know, please come and tell us what will make you stop doing this kind of conversation. And the irony of that conversation was right before I went into the meeting, it was with Brian Bond, who is the official liaison to the LGBT community, and now he's gone to work on as the campaign's official liaison to the LGBT community. And he said, Robin, I'm very upset that you were public and you told people that you were coming into this meeting, because this was supposed to be off the record. And I said, well, if this is supposed to be off the record, then I'm not having this meeting, because in my opinion, I have a social obligation to report back what we're talking about. And what you're saying is you want me to tell you information that you're going to use, but I can't take anything you tell me and report it back to the people that really care about gaining their rights. And he said, well, let's just say that it can be on the record, but it's going to be a lot different meeting. And he was very angry. And we walked into the meeting. There was two other people there, a legal counsel, another representative. And he looked at me and the woman, Heather Kronk, that works with Get Equal with me. And he said to the people that were working with the White House, Robin has made a statement based on her convictions and her principles that she's not willing to have this meeting off the record. And because of that, it's going to be a lot different meeting. And I just want you to be aware of that going into this meeting. And what I learned at that moment was a very, very important message that I just want to share with all of you. At that moment, what that said to me is that all the other organizations that had gone in and represented us didn't have convictions and didn't have principles, if that's how he looked at us. If he was willing to say to these other people that I had convictions and principles because I wanted our meeting to be on the record, then essentially what he was saying is that everybody else that had come in there, he didn't really respect, that they were willing to do whatever the White House said. And they were willing to put up with the bullying and the you'll take what I'll give you, instead of being willing to just say, I'm going to pressure until I get what I want. I don't like being on the opposite end of being the opposer of our president. But I will tell you that I will continue to push with Get Equal until we are fully equal under the law. And that means not only the open service of lesbian, gay, and bisexual people, but trans service. It doesn't mean only marriage rights, but the rights of undocumented queers who are being deported every single day. And I think that we have to look at it as we can't stop just because we get a social issue that's popular. We have to organize in intersectional ways. They're going to say that we are operating on principles and convictions that say we don't leave anyone behind. And if you're interested in organizing with Get Equal, I would love to talk to any of you. And we sign up people that are just willing to go to a rally and people who are willing to hit the legal aspect and people who are also willing to be arrested. So you don't have to be arrested, but we'd be happy to sign you up if that's something that you're interested in. Good. Thank you.
Okay, now we begin the question and answer period. And as I was waving this, it was to see if anybody had a question. Okay. Okay, this will probably go to John. What constitutional amendment do you think the Supreme Court will rely on to support the rights of the LGBTQ community? What about the Equal Rights Amendment?
So I think there are two main clauses of the Constitution that that pertain, and one is called the Equal Protection Clause, which has a basic principle that laws should apply equally to everybody in the country. And put one way, the greatest way to prevent abuse of minorities is to ensure that any law that you pass actually has general application to everybody. So, for instance, if you want to target people and say you can't marry or you don't have a right to the job, then nobody should have a right to the job. And that has an amazing way of making people enact much fairer laws. So there's the Equal Protection Clause, which is essentially saying that everybody should be treated equally under the law. And that's where you look at a law and saying what are the classifications it makes. And the courts have said that classifications based on race and national origin and alienage, the federal courts, those are entitled to the highest protection. that laws that treat women or treat gender differently, those are entitled to a very, very close look as well. And what is a huge question is, our community would also like laws that discriminate against lesbian and gay people to be treated with that same sort of scrutiny. So far, the courts have said that laws that target lesbian and gay people, they deserve to be treated closer. They have more scrutiny, but they don't have the same level. So that's the Equal Protection Clause. And then in very short, there's the Due Process Clause, which talks about our fundamental sort of rights as human beings. And one of those that's been recognized for centuries is a fundamental right to marry. And it's sort of looking at it and saying, and they sort of merge. And one way of thinking about it is saying that if straight people have a fundamental right to marry, that lesbian gay people should have it too, that everybody should have this choice. And that's why I like the way the California court put it, that it's every person's right to choose the person you want to marry.
Okay, this next one maybe can kind of be a split answer. If DOMA sections are dumped, what will the next step be to rid us of the rest of DOMA? Courts again, lawsuits to get other states to recognize same-sex marriage, or, and Robin, the second part, this could go to you, political pressure to get Congress to act.
Well, I'll give a really short answer, and that is that I believe the way these lawsuits are structured, that if in any one of them, and there's a case that's going to be heard on a short fast track in California called Galinsky in September, and so we don't know which one the court might take, but they're structured such that I believe they would find the Defense of Marriage Act unconstitutional across the board with respect to all 1,138 rights. There's another provision of the Defense of Marriage Act about whether states have to recognize a marriage between a same-sex couple from another state. That's not being raised in these federal lawsuits. But it's my sense that they would actually it would strike the entire statute and apply to all the cases sort of pretty
right.
quickly.
Right. Yeah. And currently there is a bill called the Respect for Marriage Act that is obviously not going to pass the House, could pass the Senate even though they haven't voted on it, but it would essentially strip us of DOMA. It would replace and say that, if the courts are not able to successfully remove it, then they would do the legislative work to do that. The problem with that essentially is, although there was lots of fanfare around Barack Obama's decision to say that he had evolved on marriage, he still is leaving it from a state's rights position. And that leaves, my fellow family in Mississippi behind enemy lines when in California we may be able to work it out. But if I was in Mississippi, you're on your own. And I think that it is going to take political pressure for us to be able to get to the point where we have to force the hand of Barack Obama to say, stop giving the political answer that's nice, that's going to get you the votes that you want, and start answering this from a moral obligation that's going to actually change political climates enough for us to get the full equality that we're asking for.
Okay, and the next one is, if the U.S. Supreme Court doesn't hear the case, then what?
So if the U.S. Supreme Court does not hear the First Circuit case related to the Defense of Marriage Act, then the Defense of Marriage Act would be unenforceable in essentially New England. And it would, to me, greatly call into question whether the federal government could enforce it anywhere in the country at that point. And the First Circuit has, in their opinion, actually said to the Supreme Court, they actually wrote almost to the Supreme Court, you need to decide this. And so I think most people are much more thinking that the U.S. Supreme Court is going to decide on the Defense of Marriage Act case. There's a lot of question of whether there's more of a question whether they take the Prop 8 case because – and if they don't take the Prop 8 case, then – it's over, and it's called Cert Denied, and it's possible it could be as early as this fall if they decide not to. The court can take as long as they want deciding whether they're going to take the case. They have enormous discretion. So, but people could once again get married in California. The decision would only have impact in the western United States where the Ninth Circuit is, and the way it's constructed, it would have only literal impact just on California.
And if DOMA is repealed and the federal government decided that they were going to honor same-sex marriages, you could have a situation for a person living in Mississippi that they could file federal income tax that shows them as married, but they'd have state, and part of, the legal, what I've heard from people that work with Freedom to Marry and others is that they're working to muddy the system so much that there's just a legal patchwork that's so screwed up that the federal government has to step in. But the problem with that is that you lose your dignity in doing that. That's exactly what Stuart and John, realized as they were filling out their 1040. Part of that shouldn't have to be happening. And, that's why you do the work now to stop it happening for people after you.
The next question is, what's Get Equal been up to since the DAD victory? Is there more action to come?
Yes. Most recently, over the last couple of months, we've been working specifically on the president to sign the executive order for federal contractors. Tomorrow, there is an LGBT reception at the White House, and we will be not a non-arrestable action, but an action at that event, because we do believe that what we have gotten is lip service from the – and I say that with all due respect – lip service from our president, but not tangible rights. And we are not naive to think that the president can pass a federal, ENDA, the Employment Non-Discrimination Act. But what we do know is that the president can take tangible actions, which is signing a federal contractor's ENDA that would say that all contracts that come through the federal government must have a sexual orientation and gender identity non-discrimination policy. If the president were to sign an executive order such as that, and he signs executive orders every single day, it would ensure the rights for millions of people that are affected in businesses that are connected to federal contractor contracts. And we feel like not only there, but also sign an executive order that would do a stop loss on binational couples. Because as many of you know, the binational relationships that are existing are just as much trouble as DREAM activists who are facing deportations. We hear from couples every single day where one couple's living outside of the country and the other partner's living here. And although they may be married in one state that allows marriage, because the federal government has DOMA, they still are not given the protection with a green card. And some of them have even faced exile where they're living outside of the country themselves because they don't want to be separated from their partner. So Get Equal's agenda is to continue to do actions that's going to press for what we can get in a political climate such as we're in, with the idea that we need to be working towards a full equality agenda. And it would be our hope, there's leadership changes happening at the Human Rights Campaign right now, and it's our hope that with that change, we're going to see some fierce advocacy for a full equality bill. And whether or not that's actually going to happen is still to be seen. But our goal is to create a strategic plan that's going to call from that, from the grassroots, from the streets, that forces our national organizations to eventually work towards something like that. Because as long as we're working in this piecemeal process of, you work on DOMA and you work on ENDA and you work on this, everyone's split up and we're not working for something that's going to get us everything, and that puts our power in a very limited capacity. So our goal is to try to create a national movement that's calling for everything. Being able to do that on limited resources when HRC sits on $40 million is, the problem.
Okay, this is kind of an extension of that. I'll leave it to you to decide among yourselves how to answer this. I'm currently fighting to stop the unjust DOMA deportation of my husband, where California registered domestic partners and married in New York. When DOMA is overturned, will federal benefits be given to registered domestic partners and, I can't read, the seven of the unions? Also, will a New York marriage exist for California couples, and will it be able to receive federal benefits?
So these are my short answers. That when DOMA, if it's overruled in the courts, a state domestic partnership will not have federal recognition in and of itself. There would have to be further action by the federal government to give it that recognition. There's also sort of a complicated legal relationship in immigration law and other federal laws, which makes this even more complicated. I think what we're hearing sort of informally is that, and maybe you could help, that if you do have a New York marriage, it's actually helping getting respect as far as from the Department of Justice, as far as not continuing on with deportation proceedings. But I think as Robin was sort of alluding to, and I'm just saying this is a simple way, it's just all of this language, it comes down to discrimination is incredibly complicated, and equality is incredibly simple. If you are treated like everybody else and given your basic dignity to marry the person you love and to have full equality and rights, we wouldn't have to be talking about all these crazy, crazy permutations. And that is what needs to be cut through. And
I would add that as every relationship even is seen through a non-same-sex relationship. So even couples that are dealing with, you know, having the laws on their side, we see immigration reform needed on so many different levels to begin with. So even with the repeal of DOMA, should that happen, I would say that safe harbor for binational couples are complicated with the need for better immigration reform to begin with, sadly. But what I have been told is that even if in California we see the repeal of Prop 8, you're still not going to have the luxury of safe harbor because of the federal government stance that has not changed. And that's going to need the repeal of DOMA and then also the federal government to move more quickly on binational couple status.
Okay. Unfortunately, we've reached a point in our program where we need to finish and thank everyone. Our thanks to Stuart Gaffney, John Lewis, and Robin McGee for their comments here today. We also thank our audience here and the listening audience. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 106th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.